Welcome to Found It to You, a monthly podcast where we talk with University of Tulsa faculty about their research, how they do it, why they love it, and what they are finding out. I'm Jolie Johnson, Hazel Rogers Professor of Media Studies at the University of Tulsa, and today we're here with Alana Newman, McFarland Professor of Psychology, as well as the Research Director of the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma. Welcome to Found It to You, Alana.
Thank you for inviting me.
Can you tell us, in one simple sentence, what you study?
I study lots of things, but what I'm going to talk to you today about is I study the importance of understanding trauma and the impact of covering trauma upon journalists.
And your background is clinical psychology?
I am a clinical psychologist, and I may be ahead of myself, but I'm a clinical psychologist who studies traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. And I spent a long time in my career studying the impact of trauma on veterans, on sexual abuse survivors. When I came to TU, I realized they didn't have a medical school, and I needed to start thinking about what group shall I study and how should I understand trauma. I was studying first responders, ambulance workers, and I was presenting some of my ideas somewhere, and a journalist stood up and said, I'm kind of like a first responder. And this was about 20, 23 years ago. We didn't think about journalists as first on the scene, and we certainly didn't think about them as targets of violence.
Which has gotten worse and worse in the last decades,
right? Yes, especially in the U.S.
So in studying journalists, you're studying both people who, by the nature of their work, are exposed to people who are traumatized as well as traumatic situations and people who are now increasingly targets of violence themselves.
Yes.
And this is in the U.S., across the world?
All over the place. So when I got here, I started studying the impact of violence on journalists. And I started looking at how many of them have something called post-traumatic stress disorder. I think most of your audience is familiar with it, but I like to remind people that post-traumatic stress disorder is a full disorder. You have to have three of those and two of these and one of these.
So what are the, let's pause for a second. What are the key elements of PTSD?
Re-experiencing symptoms, avoidance symptoms, cognitive symptoms, and hypervigilant body symptoms. And it's a specific disorder. You have to have exactly a few symptoms from each category to have this problem. So I study post-traumatic stress disorder among journalists in various surveys. And I do a lot of this work with my fabulous graduate and undergraduate students. So we looked only at that initially. And what we found is that we found that it varies quite a bit.
As far as how many journalists have some aspects of the disorder?
Or the full disorder. Or at least the full probable disorder. One of the things that's important to know about post-traumatic stress disorder is that it really can only be diagnosed by a clinician person to person. And these were using surveys, so it was more symptoms of that probably met the diagnosis. Huh. So most of the research, there's only one researcher who's actually done actual interviews. So it's probable diagnosis based on cutoff scores and having these particular symptoms. So journalists, depending on who you study, there's sort of two stories to tell. One is that they are incredibly resilient.
Huh.
90 to 100% are exposed to horrible things. We're not even going to talk about war correspondents right now. I'll get to that in a minute. But your typical sort of beat reporter, even not a beat reporter, has to do a death knock, which is what when you have to report to a family that somebody's died before they've been notified. Mm. Most young journalists end up doing things like that. Car accidents, hurricanes, tornadoes, crime. I could keep going on. This is the beat.
This is part of their job description, is to show up and, yes.
And even people who don't specialize in this area end up doing that. For 9/11, many people don't realize that most of the foreign correspondents who covered 9/11 were in for Fashion Week.
Oh, my goodness.
And so Fashion Week
reporters
who happened to be in New York ended up being correspondents covering these tragedies. So same thing for business people who ended up covering 9/11. Even if you don't work on a particular beat, it can happen.
Yes. So what you're saying, though, is that not all journalists exposed to trauma have PTSD.
Although 90 to 100% of all journalists in various studies have been exposed to trauma, only a minority, and I'll talk about what that means in a minute, go on to develop post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, they may have some difficulties here and there. In fact, I would argue that if you're doing your job compassionately, you can't help but be affected by this work.
Uh-huh.
And that's normal. But very few So it varies by study. Anywhere, and this is because of sampling problems, and I'll explain what that means in a minute, but anywhere from 4% to 25% develop post-traumatic stress disorder. It turns out that the people who cover narco drug trafficking and people who are war correspondents have the highest rates of post-traumatic stress disorder. And we more and more believe that that's also because they're the direct targets.
Ah, okay. They're always in danger. They're never not in danger. Whereas often someone doing a death knock, they aren't physically at that moment.
Well, some people are physically, but we're not exactly sure for all the reasons, but probably yes. Mm-hmm. At least they're not the direct target. Yeah. It used to be in a war zone. If you wore a media jacket, you'd be safe. But now...
Times have changed.
Mm-hmm. So this is a very different experience. So those people are at greatest risk. Mm-hmm. But our studies of more general and mixed groups of people from the University of Tulsa seem to see more from 4 to 9%, depending on it.
Which is still, you know, close to 1 in 10, right? We're getting there.
So you raise the other side of the coin. So on the one hand, pretty resilient, not 1 out of 10, but it is an occupational stress. And more and more we need to think about this as an occupational stress. And police, firefighters, ambulance workers, 9/11 dispatchers, they all have programs. They all have this as part of their culture. Journalism doesn't have it as part of their culture.
In fact, it's almost the opposite, right? A kind of myth of the hardcore reporter, nothing gets to him. It's always he. Mm-hmm. And so there's probably a hesitancy among journalists to come forward with...
And I think that exists for several reasons. You're absolutely right. One is that journalists are taught to be objective, and that to be objective means to have no emotion. Now, it's very interesting because I train also clinical psychology graduate students here at the University of Tulsa. Mm-hmm. And we train people that if they're more aware of their emotions and more, I call it emotional literacy, if they're more comfortable with knowing their own reactions, they can gather data more objectively. When I'm in the training role with journalists, we don't start having the conversations about emotion till we start talking about an audience. And I really think that journalists, because they are collecting data when they're interviewing, mm-hmm. when they're thinking about it, the questions, the news choices they make, that it's really important to start having some of this emotional literacy and being able to feel uncomfortable and know you're uncomfortable so that you could make a news choice. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're sitting here talking to me, you're deciding what to ask me.
Mm-hmm. And if I'm listening empathetically, it would be different than if I have a list of sort of boilerplate questions.
And if I were talking about something awful, you might be activated and starting to think about other things and wondering if you should console me or go, you might not be quite on your game as you are today.
Mm-hmm. But also, I have had a journalism training years ago, and you're absolutely right. Emotional literacy was not a part of the training. The idea was you leave your feelings at the door, and you are a kind of robot, allegedly just filtering facts to your reader. And I think we now understand that it's a different kind of storytelling process.
Especially with trauma survivors. So this work has led to this other side of my work, which is training journalists about what do they need to know about trauma, and what interviewing skills do they need to have that would be different? And I think journalism training is changing. It used to be that we thought about how do you interview people in power? You don't give them any choices. You don't give them any options. Mm-hmm. You're not empathetic. But it's a different kind of storytelling and interviewing that you need when you're talking to people who are disempowered. You have to develop trust. Yes. You have to go at their pace. If somebody's had all their power taken away, it's really important that you give them some control. And you can still be accurate. You can still ask difficult questions. But they're different principles of how you would interview someone. And so I spend some time working with journalists and helping them identify that, or if they're working on a particular story and they are trying to figure out something, what is it they need to know about trauma that would help them with a news choice?
So I'm getting the impression that around these two ideas, journalism and trauma, there are many different ways your work intersects with practitioners and with the students you're helping train through this, but also with a kind of public awareness. So on this podcast, we like to talk about the joys of research. So maybe if we started with that.
So I love doing my research. And one of the things that I'm able to train my students to understand is that you can do rigorous research that also can have practical implications. The other thing I love about this work is I'm always learning something new. I'm having to learn different disciplines in different fields. Right now, one of my graduate students is doing a study where she is comparing the way that Columbine was covered, the school shooting, with the way that
Stoneman Douglas,
thank you, Stoneman Douglas, is being covered. And have we changed? Have there been different news choices? Is the perpetrator mentioned more or less?
So she's doing an analysis of content, of the news content?
Content covered in the New York Times and in local coverage to see if all the things we've learned about what we should be doing differently are different.
About what journalists should be doing differently when talking with survivors victims?
When presenting the news.
Ah,
so
okay.
That's an example. And it's really fun to learn this literature to figure out what are the things we want to code, how do we want to code them. And I don't do a lot of content analysis, so that's really fun. I love setting up surveys and trying to think about what do we want to understand. I started off, as I said earlier, wanting to understand post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think that now what I really want to understand more is how does this work affect your problems, not necessarily disorders? How does it affect your work? And my lab's been working a lot on how do we measure work interference. And I've had the pleasure of having some of my psychology colleagues in industrial and organizational psychology join my lab. And so now we have clinical psychology, industrial and organizational psychology, focusing on journalism. So it's bringing together
journalism as an occupation.
As an occupation.
That has particular challenges that are trauma related.
Yes. So you get to bring all of those expertise together, and our lab meetings are just so much fun. So I really enjoy helping other people in the field develop their questions interdisciplinarily. So, for example, because this work crosses so many different fields, it's really hard to find the literature about trauma and journalism. So we have a database, and I am collecting sort of all the different articles from different fields, political science, psychiatry, communications, war. And we have a database at the DART Center website. And so just even collecting this information and seeing how it's filed is like, it's just so interesting.
Right. So tell us more about the DART Center, which is separate from the University of Tulsa. But you as the research director.
Yeah, it's not exactly separate. So the DART Center for Journalism and Trauma is a project of the Columbia School of Journalism. But we officially have a DART research laboratory, which I run. It's a funded center at the University of Tulsa. And our job is to do research, although I am the research director, I'm sort of also involved in training and some clinical matters. So we're in the middle of saying, should I just be the research director? Because as you can hear, I do a lot of different things for the DART Center. We also have an office in Australia, and we have an office in Europe.
Ah, so you're working with other researchers, journalists?
So it's primarily a journalist-run organization with some mental health folks and some researchers.
So it's truly interdisciplinary around this question of journalism and trauma, bringing together academic research and practice.
So the Australian director is also a psychologist, and she's interested in issues of resiliency. And really, because she has that region, she has been our sort of expert on adapting these to different cultures and how does culture affect certain things. But we all have to do that in terms of thinking about the context of journalism in different countries. And we do trainings all over.
What are the trainings about and what are they like?
We do various kinds of training. And over the years, it has changed. Our flagship program is we have a fellowship for a number, maybe it's 12, of mid-career journalists who do a week fellowship, and they're from across the world, examining trauma-informed reporting. So that's our flagship program. We do also several other programs like that in different countries. I go into newsrooms. Sometimes I'll do trainings of newsrooms, or any of us will. Sometimes it's after an event has happened. Sometimes it's just in general. And it's interesting, we've had increasing requests from newsrooms. It used to be that it was never the newsroom that wanted us to come. It was individual journalists. We have panel discussions. We have workshops, meetings. I was in Sri Lanka two sabbaticals ago, post-Civil War, talking about what do you need to know about trauma to tell post-conflict stories in a new way.
Uh-huh.
And teaching them also about trauma reactions and how to think about covering those in the news. Last year, I did some work with investigative reporters in the Ukraine on mm-hmm. self-care. And that's a place where it's very difficult to tell stories about corruption. And yet people continue to do that. And one of the things that we've learned is what keeps people resilient is the journalistic mission.
So journalists have chosen a line of work that exposes them to trauma, especially in the Ukraine and other places. It makes them targets as well. So they are constantly witnessing and hearing about traumatic events, as well as themselves often feeling in danger.
And talking to bereaved and grieved people on top of that.
And both, it seems, yeah. You know, what do you train them? If I'm that journalist, what would you tell me I need to do?
Well, I think that some of the research that we've done here has indicated that there are risk factors and there are things that keep you resilient. And this is true for every job. If you work in an organization that you feel supported by, that doesn't have crazy policies, that feels better, that doesn't make it perfect, but it's predictable, controllable, that's a better environment mm-hmm. to work in. And any ways in which we can make newsrooms more supportive.
More regularized, predictable, supportive.
And the same thing, and this especially gets complicated with freelancing, but ways to create community. The strongest predictor of health is social support. And I have a student who's like now trying to dissect, is it work social support or is it home social support? We don't have an answer yet for that. But social support is one of the strongest predictors of mental health and well-being across every field. And it's really poorly defined. We all know it. Like, I have one person I can rely on. I have several friends. I have people I can go to. I have my faith community. There are different ways to get social support. And we don't know which format is the best for journalists. But we do think that creating ways to have peer support and figuring out ways to cultivate social support is a piece of advice that we have, and ways to create community. And one of the things we've just been looking at is hostile environment training. So that's preparing journalists for the physical safety of being in a hazardous duty zone.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually have a tiny trauma component. We've just looked at sort of what we've been helping an organization that works with freelancers. More and more people are thinking about physical safety, less psychological safety. But my point here is part of that physical safety is knowing who to count on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important. So social support is something we talk about. We talk about cultivating mission. And this is, I think, true for all people, not just journalists. When you are feeling frustrated about your work, about the things you do, remembering why you do the work. Mm-hmm.
And that you believe in it, one hopes. Yeah.
And I think some careers are more mission-focused, and journalism is one, right. Not for everybody, but for many people, particularly, I would say, investigative reporters, different mm-hmm. fields. People do it because they have a sense of mission and cultivating that sense of mission. So we do exercises help people remember that. Those are kinds of things that we work on in terms of thinking about resiliency.
Yeah, and in working journalists.
And working journalists.
And you mentioned newsrooms because so many people are freelancers. I imagine that social support is a factor that you really need to help them understand the importance of cultivating, because so many journalists are kind of lone wolf types, right? And so I think that would be a particular challenge.
And even just people are working more remotely now, and while there's some real advantages to remote working...
It's isolating.
It can also be isolating. And I think there's also changes in newsroom culture. Drinking used to be a real part of newsroom culture,
yes.
Which has its downsides. But one of the upsides of it was that people were spending time together mm-hmm. socially after work.
In particular, I remember the war correspondents being seen as particularly communal. But what I'm thinking about as you're talking is that that's possibly because it was a response to kind of self-treatment for the PTSD likelihoods.
Yeah, I was in Haiti after the earthquake. We were doing journalism work, and I was staying at the hotel where all the journalists were. And I'll tell you, at night after, I really got to see the sort of bar culture. But it really was also, I saw what was very healthy about it, mm-hmm. which is people after devastating days coming together.
I find one of the things I'm hearing as you describe your research is that one problem unfolds as you address another one, and you can recognize and come from a variety of angles as long as the overlap remains the same, which is a journalism and trauma connection. But really, there's almost no end to the number of questions you can ask and explore.
I guess going back to the question about joy, that's the joy of this work. It's also what's overwhelming because I'm always thinking about new things and even our conversation. I'm going all over the place. But
we can see why that's exciting, yeah. Right? And why it needs to be done. The other thing is this is clearly, well, let's talk a little bit about the history of the field. And, you know, you indicated briefly, but let's say a little bit more about that. This is something that was really not even acknowledged or recognized or admitted to. Now I take it you're getting an invitation. Newsrooms are recognizing. Is there just less stigma now to the notion that there's a psychological consequence to being a journalist?
Yes. I think there are a couple of things going on. And actually, I'm going to work on a history paper where we actually look at the number of publications over time. But I think that there is a little less stigma and more journalists are coming forward saying, I've suffered, this work is hard, and the more people that do that, the better it is for the field. So stigma, it still exists, and it exists more than in police departments,
really?
Which is, it is much, still much more stigmatized, and I think it gets back to that, I'm objective. Yeah. And also, I've spoken to a lot of journalists who feel guilty, saying, I'm not the subject, why should I have a response? It's someone else's story, I'm not part of the story. So how can I possibly, they have it so much worse. And so I think there's also some guilt and shame in being affected and being moved. And again, the way I see it, we talk about something in the field called vicarious traumatization, which is if you are truly connecting with someone who's hurt, you can't help but be moved in positive and negative ways by the person you interact with. And that's a sign of being engaged and respectful and that one would have those feelings, but I think it's very uncomfortable because you are supposed to be covering that person. So there's cultural reasons I think it's difficult.
Yes, and tied with a professional identity and doing your job the way you're supposed to.
But more and more research is coming out too, and I think that's helping, and I think there's more and more stories. And I think, unfortunately, the increased violence against journalists in the U.S., that's always been the case in other places, but the increasing anti-media or press sense is probably also changing people's willingness to think about journalists as targets now. And maybe that's making it easier. It's not a reason I particularly like, but that may be changing the way people think about journalists.
There is, as you're talking, I'm recognizing that the cliche is the heartless reporter who sticks a microphone into a grieving mother's face and says, you know, how do you feel? And the reality that you know and that I know, too, is that journalists are extraordinarily sensitive, thoughtful people who don't want to be the center of the stage. And so on this podcast, we had this question about, you know, what myths can we bust? So are there myths about journalists and trauma that we should be skeptical of?
Yeah. One of the first ones is that I will just start by saying that in every profession, there are bad people. Yeah. There are people who you're like, oh, my God, I don't want them to be part of my profession. And that's true in journalists. We tend to think about all the people who make mistakes. But I have had mostly incredibly positive experiences with journalists who aspire to do the best, who have ethical guidelines. When I said this in Australia, people laughed at the idea that journalists have ethics, but they do. And they're trying to do their best. And they are very important in telling these stories, the first draft of history. It's very important. It's an important craft and it's an important job. So that's number one. And so I think that's important is that journalists deserve respect. And you can complain when you see bad news coverage, but also remember to compliment when you see good news coverage.
You know, they make it look easy. Good journalism seems effortless. And it's the bad journalism that shows you how difficult it is to tell a story responsibly and effectively.
And this goes back to the point about social support, which is one way that we can all help journalists is by, when we see something good, saying, good job.
Yes, yes. They rarely even hear back from their readers, except when they get the name wrong.
Or they get mostly even more so, which we haven't talked about. I've been studying online harassment. They get harassment. So
you're also studying then the effects of online harassment on
journalists.
Through surveys, or how do you study that?
We're just in the middle of doing that. We did one short study, and this is going to be one of my students' dissertations, but we're looking at online harassment of journalists by using online methods. We haven't figured out exactly what we're doing, but this is an increasing problem.
Right.
So that's one myth.
Mm-hmm.
The other myth is that all journalists suffer from PTSD, and that's not true. And I think I've already talked about that. And that's true for most people as well.
In fact, as you said, the majority of them do not. In spite of what they're exposed to, they themselves don't have the actual symptoms. Journalists are ethical, and they don't necessarily suffer PTSD after exposure. The one area we haven't covered that I'm interested in is the whole notion that we're just surrounded by bad news and we're all being traumatized by it. So can you talk about that a little bit?
All right. So that's another side of work that I've been doing. And I mostly focus on mass disasters. I have been trying to interview people who are the sources of news of individual events, but it's much harder to find people who are willing to go back to discuss the coverage of something they experienced.
Really?
And have a conversation. I've tried for a long time to have conversations. And I had a project once where I was trying to interview both the journalist and the photographer and the subject of a story to try to understand the differences. We had more difficulty finding sources who wanted to talk about it.
They just wanted to leave it behind? They did not want to return to it?
They declined when asked. And one of the things as a researcher is I respect that. That's the importance of research, but it also creates trouble sometimes because you can't always get your questions answered. So I have done a few interviews with people who've been covered in the news who talk about what's important. But the other side of this is trying to understand what is the relationship between distress, psychological disorders, and exposure, particularly to mass disasters. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we think about, again, the Oklahoma City bombing.
Yes.
We think about 9/11. We think about people who watch continuous coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been doing some work looking at children and adults, the effects. And so most of the studies that are done survey groups of people, sometimes over time, sometimes using local groups of people, sometimes using national representative groups of people. And they usually have a mental health kind of screen in them,
mm-hmm.
and they ask them, in non-standardized ways, how much did you either, it's usually television.
Mm-hmm.
Some newer studies ask about internet, not so much on printed press, though it's there. It's mostly televised images.
Mm-hmm.
And they ask in different ways, how much coverage did you see? And we just did a meta-analysis, which is a fancy mathematical literature review. So it's just
okay,
like
so you
reviewing.
Look at all the coverage, all the stories that have, all the studies that have been done.
You look at all the studies that have been done,
mm-hmm.
and you have very complicated ways of calculating how good they were methodologically. You are basically looking to eventually find out how much of an effect size, how much of an effect, if you combine all these studies together in one mathematical formula,
mm-hmm.
that's basically what it is, how much does it affect the end? And there's lots of choices you make, but it really is, what is the effect when you combine all these different studies on whatever it is you're studying? And in my case, we look at post-traumatic stress disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms.
Connected to amount of television coverage,
yes,
of a disaster.
Of a disaster.
And what did you find?
So what we find is in the studies, there's some people who show that even when you control for how much trauma they've had and all of this effect, that media coverage is a strong predictor. In our studies, when we put them all together,
mm-hmm.
what we find is that, yes, in fact, watching the news has a small, very small, but statistically significant effect on post-traumatic stress reactions. So it is a contributor. People don't usually have that reaction unless they have other kinds of things or they're vulnerable. So it's an important factor, but people don't develop post-traumatic stress disorder from watching it. But it is a part of mental health, so it raises some important questions. One is, clinicians don't regularly ask people, how much bad news have you been watching?
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's some clinical implications that we haven't thought about. What we do know from most of these studies is that if you experienced a personal loss and watched a lot of television,
interesting,
it increases the risk a little bit. So there's a little bit of that, and so that's also important. And then the third thing is initially, when we started looking at this literature a long time ago, particularly from the work that came out of the Oklahoma City bombing, we thought that all children were affected regardless of whether they experienced loss or not. In adults, it was only those with loss or not. It's not looking that way, but children are affected. So I'm in the midst of trying to figure out, looking at the data, what advice to give parents. And I'm looking at parent media literacy campaigns to see, can I bring those two pieces of information together to have some evidence-based all of what I've been talking about is taking evidence and then trying to apply it to these problems from different fields.
And sharing those findings widely. So you are also a public scholar, obviously. From these findings, they don't just show up in academic journals. You're also doing public work.
Yeah, I almost always try. So I have this fancy meta-analysis, and now I'm trying to develop, okay, what do clinicians need to know from this? What do parents need to know? Maybe what educators need to know. So I always try to do one academic piece and then one practical piece tied to that work.
So it's evidence-based, but it directly translates that evidence to how to use it in the real world.
Yeah. And that's, you know, you asked again about joy. That's the joy, is being able to do all that.
Of course. I'm so glad you were a guest. I think there's a lot that our listeners will want to follow up on. As I understand it, you do have a website for the DART Center. So that URL will be in our description, and so
Great.
People can find out more. I'm Jolie Jensen, and this has been Found It to You, a monthly podcast produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa on the TU campus. We've been talking with Alana Newman, McFarland Professor of Psychology, and Research Director of the DART Center for Journalism and Trauma. Please join us next month for another chance to hear a University of Tulsa faculty member discuss, in everyday language, the nature and value of their research.